guest today on the 20 Years of 24 podcast. Would you please welcome Chris Diamantopoulos to the show?
Welcome.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
It is a thrill to have you on here. I was preparing before the show. One of the great joys of doing this podcast is I get to watch a lot of TV and film.
Cool.
And when we heard you were coming to the show, I said, look, I know Silicon Valley, Arrested Development, Let's Get Physical. I know so many things that he's been a part of. I'm sure I know almost everything he's done. And then I went on IMDb and I went, oh my gosh, I know about this much of the stuff that you've done, including 24. There's so many things. So again, being Canadian too, I mean, we're excited to have a Canadian on the show.
Yes, yep.
And we're glad that you're here to talk to us about 24 and everything
else. It's my pleasure. To quote Indy, I'm like a bad penny. I always turn up.
Beautiful.
But yeah, no, definitely, man. This is my I was saying very recently that I loved being a part of 24 as much as I loved being an audience member of 24. My I remember before we had kids, we would miss a season for whatever reason, and we would go to the video store and get the DVD set and binge watch, you know, before binge watching was a thing.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great fun.
Well, your character, Rob Weitz, on season 8 of 24 was an amazing character. The audience loved him. I mean, right up until the end, until you betrayed the president, and then she had you arrested, and she slapped you on the face. That was a pretty, great scene of that season.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, tell us about how you got involved with 24 and what your experience was like playing that character.
I'll say, if you're going to be slapped in the face by anyone, you want it to be Cherry Jones.
Absolutely.
And I just have to say, I've never met a more professional and dear soul. She is just, I mean, you know, she's what a TV star and a movie star should be, because she has all the goods to back it up, and she has all the good in here as well. Mm-hmm. She is just tremendous. Working with her was an absolute joy. And then the little pepper sprinkled on top of that, which was even better, was having Bob Gunton in our little triumvirate.
Right.
Because it was, I mean, between the two of them and me, we're all theater folk. And so we were singing duets and trios, and we were, you know, bringing out the musical theater. It was so much fun. And I've been a long fan of Bob Gunton's. I think that he was just such a tremendous character actor.
Yes.
And a real great analog for where I hope one day my career to be able to touch. You know what I mean? He did so many iconic roles. But anyway, how did I get involved in 24? It's funny. It's not necessarily a romantic or exciting story. It's the joy and plight of every actor. I was desperately hunting for a job. I needed a gig emotionally. I needed a gig financially. I needed a gig creatively. I really wanted to get a job. And it had been a challenging year, I remember, in pilot season, which was really a thing back then.
Right.
Auditioning, getting close, didn't get it. Screen testing, you're close, you're one of two, didn't get it. Oh, this one is yours, it's yours to lose. I lost it. You know, it just wasn't happening. And when 24 came up, I remember I was sort of at the end of my rope, and I thought, if I don't get this, I might hang it up. I might just sort of pack it all up and say, I'm done here, which was a really silly notion, a silly thing to think, because that feeling never goes away. You know, here I am 11 years later, and I'm still hunting and fighting for a job, not because my career isn't any good, but because that's what we do as actors, you know?
Right.
It's not necessarily like you build some sort of career, you know, hierarchy. We're vagabonds. You finish a gig, you carry on. So anyway, when the audition came to me, I remember the one thing that I thought that I stood a chance with. I thought that I might be a little young for the role, but the role was really verbose and particularly carried a lot of expositional dialogue. You know, letting the audience know precisely what was happening in a very, you know, well-written and fluid way.
Right.
And I thought that might be my ace in the hole, because I'm a fast talker. I'm really good at learning and memorizing lines, and I can deliver dialogue that is lengthy, and I can make it quick without it sounding like I'm speaking quickly. And I thought, you know, that could really sort of, that maybe that'll help. And sure enough, it did. And I remember actually when I was waiting to find out if I got the role, we went to Palm Springs. That weekend, I think I auditioned on a Friday. Maybe auditioned on a Thursday, didn't hear anything on the Friday, decided to go away for the weekend on the Saturday and Sunday, and thought, you know, if I go away, I won't think about it. And I think it was on the way home that we found out that I got it, and I had to pull over and just sort of like, oh, thank God. You know, it was just such a great feeling.
Was that an audition and decided from Fox or Howard Gordon?
It wasn't, and it was, this was back in the day when everything happened live and in person.
Okay.
And yes, it was Howard Gordon and Fox. And I, if I'm not mistaken, I read for Howard. I think I did an audition first for casting, and then they brought me back and I read for Howard. And boy, what a, I mean, we could do an entire hour long podcast on the mind of Howard Gordon, couldn't we? but also on the character of Howard Gordon, because, you know, he's a gifted and brilliant writer, but he also fully understands how the industry works. And I don't know this for a fact, but I've experienced it anecdotally. I think that Howard Gordon loves actors, and I think it shows in the way that he writes for his characters. And I certainly felt like the benefactor of a great role. And I think they took a chance on me, because at that point, not from the standpoint that I wasn't a vetted actor. I'd been doing it for a good amount of time, but I hadn't necessarily landed in either comedy or drama. I was still rather amorphous. So I'm still very grateful to Howard.
You're probably still very amorphous.
I mean, that's now by virtue. So it's funny, what happened after 24 was there was a bit of a crossroads for me. And, you know, you hear actors that are, you know, hugely successful actors talking about how they choose their roles. And that's the luxury that I haven't largely had in my career. And I've been doing this a long time. And that's not to say that I haven't had opportunities to accept an offer or pass on an offer. That the trajectory of my career isn't necessarily only in my hands. It's determined by virtue of what opportunities are presented to me, right? And I never know how long an opportunity will go. I certainly didn't know Silicon Valley would be more than an episode or two, and it turned into its own thing. And, sure. You know, there are various things that will turn out that way. You know, when I set out to be an actor, the truth of the matter was, it's silly to say, because, you know, I pit myself against the best. When I was probably 16 or 17 years old, I wanted to be Daniel Day-Lewis. I wanted to be Johnny Depp. I wanted to be Gary Oldman. I wanted to be somebody that was unrecognizable in every job that he did. And one of the reasons I had such a hard time finding agents and a manager was because they were like, you're never going to be able to do that.
We don't want to represent.
Yeah. Go and be you. Yeah. And I don't want to be me. It's boring being me. I want to be someone else. And it was 24 that actually highlighted for me that even in playing a non-character, you have to find the character.
Right.
And Rob Weiss couldn't be further from who I am. There was a slight vocal cadence difference that I adopted when I played him. Mm-hmm. It was a carriage difference. I remember speaking at length with Howard about the suit, because they brought me in to do a wardrobe fitting, and all the suits were rather boxy, traditional sort of Washington suits. And I said, if this guy is chief of staff and he's this young, he's going to look better than all his predecessors.
Sure,
and
he said, exactly. Well,
And so at the time I was sartorially engaged. I loved clothes. I mean, I wore clothes for a living as an actor. So I was in New York and I went to Paul Stewart, which is an old, you know, establishment, a gentleman's establishment.
Right.
But they're the New York equivalent of Savile Row in many regards. Super, right. You know, super tailored, high in the armhole, you know, the roped shoulders, a nice, a really, really beautiful silhouette, trim trousers. And I remember when they first saw the suit on, and they trusted me. I went and I had two suits made, and I brought them in for the fitting. They had them made a couple of weeks later. We were in LA, and they were vacuum sealed to my body. And you can even see, even in the picture, it's really, really quite different than all the other suits that the people wear. And absolutely. Howard said, "Are you sure that's not too tight?" I said, no, it's not too tight. Not too tight. It keeps him upright. And it's exactly, this guy is like, he knows when he's eaten a calorie more than he should have eaten.
Right, right.
And it really added something. And I remember Howard even saying, I like the suit. Suit looks good. Suit works.
I was going to say, this probably isn't the suit Chris would wear exactly.
Yeah,
it's
right.
It's the one that Rob would wear.
That's right. It's the one that Rob would wear.
exactly what you said, that if I gain a calorie, I'm going to notice this. And there's a reason why I'm in this position at this age.
That's right.
And
that's
everything about your suit should carry.
Everything is measured. Everything is precise. He was like the, it's a terrible example, but he's sort of like C-3PO, right? He's like Tim Gunn, right? Right. But none of the grandeur, but really he had to keep everything just so. I mean, he wasn't saying designers, you know, he wasn't doing that, but he was, it was, you know,
thanks. That was a good Tim Gunn. That was a very
I watch a lot of Project Runway. My wife has the remote control, and I have to say, thank goodness. Designers, I'm troubled. Gather around, let's caucus.
My wife is a big Tim Gunn fan too. She actually she was included in one of his mentoring books a couple years ago. Yeah. She shared a story and he included it, and she's happy. That's all she needs in life.
Dude, come on.
Tim Gunn included her in
the book. The Tim Gunn inclusion.
The Tim Gunn inclusion was very cool.
So anyway, that was a tangent. I was basically saying that I set out to be unrecognizable, and you know, it's a hard thing to do when you're not an A-list actor. When you're just an actor looking for work, it's hard to sort of cobble that kind of career together. But I have to say, you know, it's been a lot of fun, and I've gotten a great opportunity to play roles that I had that unless it was by the grace of casting directors, producers, and directors who were like, yeah, there's something there, I never, by virtue of what I look like, I should have been much more limited in the roles that I've gotten to play. And I'm hoping to push that in the next decade and beyond. I'm really hoping to come out with some doozies.
Well, you also starred in, you know, the Three Stooges and Mickey Mouse, and you had, those were big roles you starred in, and in Silicon Valley and many other roles. We considered you an A-list celebrity. So.
Well, listen, you know, first of all, that's very kind of you. I'll say this, you know, Stooges was a passion project for me. I grew up in Toronto. I don't know if you guys remember, but WUTV Buffalo 29 used to do the reruns of the Stooges after school. And I would time my VCR with a tape in it, and I would tape them. And I was obsessed with the Stooges. My grade 6 speech. Remember when we had to do speeches, like you could do volcanoes or dinosaurs or what?
Yep.
Mine was Mo Howard.
I was going to say, was Mo your favorite Stooge?
Well, it's funny. Truth be told, I loved Larry because when shit was going on, you look at Larry, he's the funniest. Like, he's so funny.
So my friend in the VHS days, one of my best friends used to rent. We used to go to a video store and rent all the Stooges films. I actually own them all now. I've got them right over in the other room. But we used to rent every single one. And my best friend, because I was watching Curly and Moe, that was, you know, those are the two that I watched.
Yep.
And one of my best friends said, watch Larry. Exactly what you just said. And I went, it changed everything.
It does.
Because he was reacting.
It's true. And his reactions were priceless. But here's the thing, though. I did a deep dive into the Stooges when I was doing that speech for sixth grade. And there weren't many books back then. I went to the world's biggest bookstore in Toronto. Okay. And there was a book called The Stooges Scrapbook. And I pored over it, and I learned that Mo wasn't only the leader on screen. He was the driving force behind that. And there was, it warmed me to him, because none of anything that they did would have ever happened if it wasn't for Mo.
Right.
He kept it going. And that stuck with me. And I remember when I heard that the Farrelly brothers were making that movie, I remember thinking, what a terrible idea. I was on Broadway at the time in Les Mis. And I was just like, don't do that. The Stooges are the Stooges. Leave it be. And I love the Farrelly brothers, but don't touch it. Don't touch it.
Yeah.
And it never went anywhere for over 10 years, to the point where when I got to LA and I was, you know, pounding the pavement and grinding it out and trying to get work.
Yeah.
I heard about these auditions they were having. And I called my agent and my manager, and I was like, I love the Stooges. And my agent was like, smart to point out, okay, you love the Stooges, but you can't be, look at you. You who are you going to be? And I said, I said, nobody knows more about the Stooges than I do. My agent, my manager said, we're not going to be able to get you an appointment. You're not a stand-up comic, and nobody knows who you are. And so I crashed the first audition. I made a wig and a costume with, you know, foam under my neck, and I sort of pulled face, and I got there, and everyone was in jeans and a t-shirt. There was a big sign that said, please do not come in character.
Oh, come on.
But here's the thing. How the hell are you going to be a stooge looking like this?
Yeah.
You know? And so when they opened the door, I signed in. When they opened the door and said, okay, this is Chris Diamantopoulos, there was an audible, ugh, from the writer and the producer. They were like, oh, because I had this terrible costume on, but I didn't break character once.
Right,
I was Mo the minute I walked in, and I stayed Mo for 6 months of auditions. It was 14 auditions over 6 months, and the role wasn't mine, and the role might be mine, and then it wasn't, and then it might. And then finally, Pete Farrelly called me, and he said, I'll never forget it. I was driving. I was on Laurel Canyon. And he said, is this Mo? And I said, this is Chris. He said, well, listen, I went to bed last night, and I thought, if I don't give you this role, God's going to give me cancer. And he said, so you got the part. But I'll tell you what, man, that was it was such an adventure for me. And sure. I did that part for minimum wage because I wrote a letter to the head of Fox saying, I know I'm not a celebrity. I know I'm not a list, and I know I'm not a stand-up comedian, but nobody knows Mo better. I will do this for free. And when the contract came in, it was for minimum wage. I ended up spending $15,000 to move my family to Atlanta so that we could make the movie.
But for that role. But for that,
I'd do it again for double.
Yeah, yeah. And there was a sign that said, please don't come in character. So that audible, that when they walked in the room must have really paid off 6 months later when you actually got the role.
Oh, man. It was, I'll tell you, that was the odyssey. That 6 months was a perfect example that I need to remember. I forget it all the time, but it was a perfect example of just keep your head down and do the good work. You know, sometimes it doesn't work out, but. A good friend of mine who's much older than me and a much better actor than I'll ever be, Nick Wyman, said to me recently, your job is to audition. Your job isn't to get the part. Your job is to audition. Wow. So quit complaining and just audition. And I forget that very often, and I yell at my agents and this and that, and it's a stupid thing for me to do. The truth is, get the opportunity, do your best, and carry on.
Well, I'm going to share a story from my childhood. That there's so many parallels, it almost isn't going to make my head explode. But Popeye, I found Popeye released on Blu-ray a couple months ago, just before Christmas, and I went and bought it because I remember going to the theater to see Popeye with the whole family, with my grandmother's homemade hamburger, sneaking him in the theater. We went to see Popeye downtown Windsor, and I was 10, right? And I was not a film critic by any level, but I remember months before, I was enough of a Popeye fan that I went, oh, please don't ruin this. Oh, please. Like, I know Robin Williams is amazing. And again, I know Robin Williams is a parallel for you. But it was that moment of, oh, please don't let this suck. Because Popeye is like here and Robin Williams is here. But if he ruined it. And I remember the same feeling you described about the Three Stooges going, I've lived with these guys since I was like born. And I remember thinking, and then all the cast changes that happened and everything else. And then when I saw it on screen, because I went to the theater to see it. Stooges, and I saw, I was not a big fan of, why can't I think of his name, Larry?
Oh, of what Sean Hayes did.
Sean Hayes. Yeah. Sean Hayes, Will Sasso, I love Will Sasso from day one. Again, 2/3 of the Stooges were Canadian, gotta love that.
It's crazy.
But I went to see it in the theater, and I went, oh my gosh, they actually pulled it off.
Oh, like, cool, this, man, this that's is, nice to hear.
You know, the expectation was here.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny, it wasn't a perfect film. By any stretch of the imagination. And the way the Farrelly brothers work, and I love them very, very much. Mm-hmm. They have a very, very specific way that they work, which is very casual. It was, for me, that movie was a passion project from the moment I started auditioning to the day I went to the premiere in character, in costume. That was an homage and a veneration to my hero, Mo Howard. It was my chance to say, hey, listen, you did something that kept entertaining people for 100 years later. Okay. Yeah. I'm just a schmuck from East York. I'm nobody, but I have a chance here to do this thing that inspired me. And there are kids that will now hopefully watch you because they got to see this.
Yeah.
So that was it for me, you know? And I mean, the film has shortcomings as many films do. But I'm proud of the work.
I watched it again because it's on, over here, it's on Disney Plus.
Oh, cool.
Everywhere else in the world, Disney Plus has added the Fox content to.
So it's like 24 and.
24 cool. and everything. Yeah. So I watched it again the other night. And even though I own the Blu-ray copy, I'm still watching it on streaming. But I remember having the same feeling when I was in the theater. I was like, they made it work. I was not a fan of Sean Hayes. But Sean Hayes nailed Larry. And it wasn't even, I didn't see it as an imitation. I saw it as an homage, as you said.
Yeah, no, I have to say, Sean and Will they poured their hearts into it too. And I have to say, I was the Stooge fan, the big Stooge fan of the three of us. And they looked to me often for authenticity. And I have to say, by the end of the film, I was looking to them for authenticity because they were devouring Stooge shorts.
Right.
And we would get together hour before our makeup call in one of our trailers, and we would have a bunch of stuff pulled up on the iPad for the fight sequences. And it would be like, okay, let's try this. You know, okay, I'm going to slap you back, and I'm going to poke you, and then I'll duck, and then we'd show up on set, and Pete would say, all right, what are we doing today, Mo? And I'd say, all right, guys, you stand over there. Okay. He'd say, great. Put the cameras over there. Let's shoot. And it was just like, it was so cool. It was really neat, man.
And then you've taken on the risk many other times before. Old Man Parker.
Again, oh, man.
An established character. And Mickey Mouse.
Look at you.
I mean, that's again, to take on those that people have known and grown up with. I mean, Christmas Story has become one of those everybody watches every single year. And of course, Mickey Mouse. My goodness.
I mean, I wear Mickey like a badge of honor, like you wouldn't believe. And I remember it was shortly after The Stooges came out that my agents called and said, listen, there's a very quiet search for a throwback to the original Walt.
Right.
Revoicing of Mickey.
Yeah.
Given that, you know, you just did Stooges and that was kind of the same era. Is this something you want to touch? I said, I don't want to touch it.
Right.
I said, you know, that's holy ground. You know, why don't they use the guy who's been doing it? Who's the guy who's been doing it? And then I went and I watched the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse stuff. And Brett, who does Mickey Mouse for the Mickey Mouse Clubhouse stuff, he's terrific. He's a terrific Mickey. He's the Mickey that my children watch. But his Mickey is decidedly not like Walt Disney's.
Not Steamboat Willie, yeah.
Yeah. That isn't to say that he isn't a wonderful Mickey. His Mickey entertains and has entertained millions and millions of people. He's terrific. But if what they wanted was the Walt Mickey, that wasn't the Mickey. And the main distinction, or the two main distinctions, I think, is that Brett's voice is naturally high. Hmm. He's not going into a falsetto per se. His voice is naturally high. Walt's voice, and this is what changed my opinion. I said, no, I don't want to audition for it. And then they were doing remember that movie that Tom Hanks made with Emma Thompson about about Walt Disney?
Oh, Walt Disney, yes.
Yeah. Well, when that was coming out, they had all these documentaries about Walt. I was at home and I was watching, and sure enough, there was this documentary and I watched Walt talking, and he had a very low voice because he smoked a lot. And when he spoke, his voice, he was all the way back here. And the interviewer asked him to do Mickey, and I'll lower my gain here. And he went, oh boy, you know, and I saw him engage his body. And I looked at his face when he was doing it, and I thought, oh, I think I can do that. And then I thought, well, if they want Walt, I mean, when I went back and looked at the shorts, Mickey in the 30s, he was a rapscallion. He was like Mo. He'd kick Pluto in the ass. He'd yell at so-and-so and come on, stupid. You know, it was amazing. It was like Mickey Mo. You know what I mean? There was something really, really quite similar. And I think, it was inspiring to me. And the audition itself was terrific. I had to go to the Disney Animation, to the place where it's all done.
In secret.
And I had to revoice The Brave Little Tailor, which is a classic, you know, Mickey short. And it was, and basically it was me matching line for line, which was just a joy to do. And I remember when they called and said, they're going to try you on a pilot episode. My agent said, don't hold your breath on this because Disney doesn't want to have two voices of Mickey. They want Mickey to be Mickey. And I said, look, I'm not trying to step on anybody's toes. I'm just saying if what they want to do is make a Mickey, and what they wanted was they wanted Mickey to sing, and they wanted him to have reactions that were, you know, bigger than just that sort of, you know, Mickey has long been relegated to just sort of corporate mascot. But in the beginning, Mickey had a ton of personality. And so, you know, each episode they would say, okay, we'll do another one. Okay, we'll do another one. Okay, we'll do another one. And then after a season, okay, we'll do another one. But never was it like, you know, Celebration, you're our new Mickey. It wasn't until many, many seasons in that, someone from Disney sort of, you know, acknowledged and patted me on the shoulder and was, you know, saying like, hey, you know, welcome and congrats, and the stuff is great. So, and I wear it like a badge of honor. I love doing Mickey more than anything.
And please tell me, as a dad, does that get you a lot more credit at home being Mickey Mouse?
I have to say, man, I do have to pinch myself occasionally, because one of the things that my kids like to watch is Mickey. And it's, you know, I'd like to think that it's because it's me, but they don't watch a lot of my other stuff. And I certainly don't make them watch it. I think it's because what Paul and the team have done on those shorts is just, I think that it engages them the way that Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck engaged me. I loved those. Those shorts were my childhood. Yeah. So, and I look at the Disney stuff, the Mickey stuff, and the Mickey stuff, it's so in that vein. So much of it is for grownups.
Yep.
And it goes over the heads of the kids. Yeah. It's terrific, man.
It's a dash of, I watched several episodes. And you've given me a whole list of stuff I need to catch up on. But I watched the first five or six right off the bat. There's a hint of Bugs Bunny and a hint of Ren and Stimpy.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
In there. And anybody listening to the podcast needs to go find the one called No Service, because it addresses the fact that Mickey doesn't wear a shirt and Donald doesn't wear pants.
Oh yeah. It fully does. And they go there. And actually, if you watch the new ones, The Wonderful World of Mickey, they're longer shorts.
Okay.
And they're terrific. They're so beautifully drawn. I mean, the backgrounds that they draw, I wish I could live in those, but also the musical element. And this is something that I started out in musical theater. I worked on Broadway for 15 years, 8 shows a week, show after show. I never thought that I'd be able to bring music into on-screen stuff. And Mickey was one of the first times I got a chance to really sing. Now I'm singing as Mickey. Although no, in the Christmas special, I do a Bing Crosby impersonation and then it's revealed that it's just Mickey singing along to his favorite record. But that really sort of reignited my love of singing, and I absolutely adore it.
Sure. Christmas, and I get a Christmas Story Live.
Well, so then you bring up a Christmas Story Live. So when I was in Halifax, shooting Let's Get Physical, and the director of the first national tour I ever did, Scott Ellis, we both started out together. I was a kid. He called me up. He was the director. He was directing Christmas Story Live. And he said, hey, listen, if I offer you this, if I get Fox to say, okay, will you say yes? I said, well, what is it? He said, just, will you say yes? I was like, I have to know what it is. He said, no, you just, will you say yes? I said, yes, I'll say yes. He said, it's a Christmas Story. I was like, wait, the movie? He said, no, the musical. I was like, there's a musical of a Christmas Story? He said, yeah. I said, what part? He said, the old man. I was like, now wait just a minute. I was like, I'm not the old man. I'm way too young to be.
Sure.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, and I said, that's the other thing. I said, I don't want to touch that. That guy was perfect. I love, you know, and he said, the musical's a little different and we really need someone with singing chops and we need someone to be able to dance around and, you know, just say yes. And I said, all right. And then I watched like a bootleg copy of the Broadway show. And I thought, what the hell have I gotten myself into? This is a lot of, I mean, it's a real song and dance thing. And
we saw it in Detroit.
It's really a tremendous show. And look, there are purists.
Set changes?
Yeah, the set changes, all of that stuff. There are purists who love the movie that think that the musical is sacrilege. Just,
it was amazing.
Take a deep breath, everybody. Yep. It was an inspiration. And I thought that the musical was just tremendous. And I thought that the idea was terrific as well. And I used it as a chance to live out my fantasies, because growing up, my hero, other than Mo, was Danny Kaye. I wanted to be Danny Kaye.
Wow.
And so I used it as a chance to live out my movie musical fantasy. And I really imbued almost too much Danny Kaye, much to Scott Ellis's chagrin. He was like, well, what are you doing? I was like, I'm entertaining myself. But I, when I was a kid, thought that movie musicals were musicals that were just filmed. You know, you were doing it live. And little did I know that there were edits and cuts. But for ours, I mean, the first time I ever did that major award number, the first time I ever did it in full, was the live production.
Wow.
Because the stage was plexiglass and the snow was oil-based. So when the snow would land on the stage, it was an oil slick. And so all of us dancers, we were sliding all over it. So they had to cure the stage with like a sandpaper and we couldn't get on it. And so I remember producer saying to me, do not do the flip. Don't, we had choreographed a flip in the rehearsal hall. Don't do the flip in the song because you might fall, and don't fall. Just, you know, and when I got, and we'd never even practiced the, I did this where they remove my clothes. The camera comes in nice and tight on my face. And I have dressers that are removing my old man Parker clothes, and I'm wearing a tuxedo underneath, and then the camera zooms out and you see me in my tuxedo.
You've changed.
We'd never practiced it. We never practiced it once. And
amazing.
And it was once they got that, and I was on the stage, I thought, I'm just, you know, this is, when am I ever going to get a chance to have a live performance where I can just go for it? And boy, oh boy, that was something else. And working with Matthew Broderick and Maya Rudolph, and I'd worked with Maya a few times in the past, and they're both just such lovely people. And Matthew in particular, just so self-effacing and so, I really enjoyed working with him. He's such a nice guy. just great. Really, really great.
Russ Hanneman, true pleasure to meet you.
Oh, yeah. I think I recognize you from TV.
Yeah, you do.
With all your successful roles, is there a role that, you know, that you dream about revisiting potentially one day that you would like to, say a role gets revived, you know, is there something that you could see yourself, oh, I would love to play that character again?
Man, you mean a character that I've played?
Yes.
That I could play again?
Yes.
It's a great question. Well, if you had Cherry and Bob back, I would do Rob Weiss in a heartbeat. You know, yeah. If they come to visit me in a cell somewhere locked up below Fort Knox.
I mean, Rob didn't die. I mean,
no, Rob's not dead.
You can't say that a lot of people on 24, but Rob is still dead. Alive.
You know, I did this little TV movie that cost, I think the budget was $450,000, and it aired opposite the NCAA championship finals. I think the viewing audience on the night that it aired was 68,000 people. So nobody watched it, and it had no budget, and it was meant to just be a throwaway sort of salacious little thing, but it meant a great deal to me. I got to play Robin Williams in this biopic, which was called Behind the Camera of Mork and Mindy. It was meant to just be one of those silly movies, but mm-hmm. I didn't view it that way. It was a chance for me to pay homage to a great idol of mine. And so if there was ever a chance to do something on a bigger scale and play Robin and tell that story, I would do that in a heartbeat.
I mean, in the same way that Robin delivered Popeye in a way that satisfied me as a kid, seeing you play Robin, the cadence, you got down. I remember one scene in the comedy club where you get off the stage and people are approaching you about opportunities, and the cadence you had matched Robin. Like you clearly you studied the man, because yeah. It was like, that's when you talked about being able to talk fast. I mean, if you can do that playing Robin Williams, you've got it. But boy, difficult roles.
It was beautiful. I mean, the challenge of course was, look, he was still alive of course at the time, and the show didn't ask for his permission. So the challenge, the night before we started shooting, they were issued with a cease and desist. And I had to go through with the writer and find impressions that he had never done before. So for every impression, we had to change everything, and we had to change, you know, a great deal of it. I think the thing that always made me sad about that was the notion that as an actor, I would have wanted him to know that it was meant to be an homage to him, and not anything salacious. And certainly the subject matter didn't end up necessarily going salacious. It definitely did sort of paint him as someone who conquered his demons. But anyway, yeah, it was tremendously fun. It was 3.5 weeks in Vancouver. Neil Fearnley directed it. And it was, I for 3.5 weeks didn't sleep and wasn't me. I was him.
You were him.
I just allowed myself to go there, and it was something.
In the same way Jim Carrey became what can I think of his name? I love Lotka.
Oh yeah, man.
He's so good. You became Lotka. But yeah, you became Robin Williams for those 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Well, we talked about fatherhood a minute ago. Let's talk about another great father, Russ Hanneman.
Oh man. Yeah, he's the patron saint of all fathers.
Well, I didn't tell you to go to bed. You were told to go to bed.
That's right. You know what's funny about that? So I'll say this. Alec Berg and Mike Judge, who are, you know, the brains behind Silicon Valley, who also happen to be two of the nicest and smartest guys I've ever worked with. They told me that everything that they had my character do was researched by them in the Valley. That bit was a VC who had his tech hook up an AI to his Sonos.
It's good parenting.
It's true. And they said, you know, so much of the stuff that they wanted to put in the show, they couldn't even put in, and it was real because no one would buy it. But the great thing about Russ and Silicon Valley, truthfully, was all I had to do was show up because it was so well written. I will say this, though, there is a story. I was a fan of the show before I found out about the audition. I loved the show. And then my agent called and said, he said, you've got an audition for Silicon Valley. I said, oh, that's great. I love that show. And he sent me the material. You know, they send you the audition pages, and it was like 12 pages or so. And I always like to be prepared. So I, you know, memorized the stuff. I made a choice for the character. And when I went into the audition, the casting director said, let me make sure you have the right material. Oh, gosh, no, we changed the character. They rewrote the character. He's different. And I said, well, I worked on, I mean, it's 12 pages. And she said, do you want to go wait in the waiting room, you know, and we'll see you when you're ready. And I was like, but it's 12, like, I'm not going to just be ready. I mean, I'll come in. It's going to be a terrible audition. Let me just do this material. He said, I don't know what to tell you. I know that Mike, they've changed the character. And I said, let me do what I prepared. And she said, okay. So I did what I prepared, drove home, and was feeling kind of itchy about it. And so I called my agent and said, look, will you let me know what's going on with that one? Because I really love the role and I love the show. He said, yeah, I'll let you know. And a few days went by, I didn't hear anything. So I called him again. So what's going on with that role? He said, you might want to let that one go. I said, why? He's like, just, there's other things. I said, why? He said, I think they're interested in someone else. I said, who? He said, it's just someone else. I said, is it another client of yours? He said, yes, it is. I said, okay, who?
Give me an answer now.
And he said, it doesn't matter. I think the ship has sailed. I said, but I didn't do the material. And I looked at the new material after the fact, and it's much funnier material, and I should just do it. He said, I think the ship has sailed. And he said, they're looking at John Bernthal, who's a terrific actor, but he's not Russ Hanneman. No way.
No
way. And I said, I'm sorry. I think he's terrific. I'll see everything he's in. That's not, we can't do that. He said, I don't know what to tell you. So I called the casting office and I said, look, please let me come back in and do the material. And they said, well, they haven't made an offer yet. Come on in. And so I went in and we had a great time with the material. And I don't know if they offered it to him and he passed and then I ended up getting it. But all I knew is that Monday I got the part.
It was you gave it the shot you wanted to give it.
I did indeed. Yeah. And it was fun.
You channeled your inner Rob Weiss.
That's right. I channeled my Weiss.
The casting director.
That's right. I will say this, that when I got to set, because my performance was here.
Yeah.
All of the other actors, I mean, I remember Thomas, I remember Kumail, I remember them looking at me like, and they would look at like Mike and Alec and like, what is this? And I remember after my first take of my first scene, they all walked back to Mike and Alec at the monitors. And I'd be like, what is he doing? You know, and then they walked back and Mike and Alec came over to me after they walked off set. And I looked at them, I'm like, oh shit, like, you know, my performance is too big or whatever. And Mike just looked at me and went, keep doing exactly what you're doing. And I was like, okay. And Alex said, they're just so uncomfortable and it's beautiful.
Particularly who the lead was. My gosh. I mean, there couldn't be more of a contrast between you and him.
Thomas Middleditch, another Canadian. Middleditch,
amazing. Yep, I've seen him on, but who he played in that show.
Yeah.
Couldn't have been more different than Russ, but he needed Russ and Russ needed him.
Yes, indeed. Indeed. Yeah. No, that was
fun. Who did you channel for Russ?
You know, this is going to sound terrible because my brother is the nicest, best guy in the world. And he's not a cheesy guy. My brother's awesome and he's brilliant, but there's something acerbic about his energy. And he's also he's just quick to move from one thing to the next.
That
idea of, okay, but yeah, well, that energy was something that felt right for Russ. Like, and my brother also, you know, he likes the finer things. So the notion of Russ loving his car and loving his jeans, it felt very, my brother's name is Gus. So I was just like, oh, I think there's a little bit of Gus in Russ. Yeah.
I saw at least a little bit or a lot of W.C. Fields.
Yeah.
I'm here. I'm in the room. Can you see me? I'm here. Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely. That's right. Absolutely. What was the thrill of being?
Well, I mean, look, when you're given carte blanche to say anything, and when your build in the first episode as the worst human being in the world, you can't lose. I mean, there's really something wonderful about, well, if I am the worst, then nothing I say will be offensive because I've already offended everybody. And there was something really quite marvelous about being able to just be the world's greatest douchebag. It was fun. I mean, the other thing that was really cool about it was I hadn't necessarily, you know, single camera comedy is a really, really challenging device. I mean, we grew up watching Family Ties, Night Court, Who's the Boss? We grew up watching multicam comedy where line, joke, line, set up, big joke, line, joke, right? And there's a cadence to that that worked. Now, the reason that, I mean, Seinfeld, right? Just the perfect comedy. Exactly. Now, it's not lost on me that Alec Berg was a writer on Seinfeld and is also, you know, the guy behind Silicon Valley, right? So I haven't loved a lot of single camera comedies. I think The Office is absolutely brilliant. So that's one that I definitely love. But Silicon Valley is one of very few that I think are just really brilliant comedies. And so the great joy for me was being able to mine real humor in a medium that I didn't necessarily find the funniest. You know what I mean? So that was a great joy. And working with those actors was a lot of fun because they're really quite talented.
Like, I can guarantee that there's nobody else in the history of television that's going to be able to say rebillionizing.
There's a ton of catchphrases. I mean, there's you know.
Yeah. Yes, there is. There's careful, he's gonna peel out.
It's true. I and you know, also in as an actor, I never thought that I would actually have a tequila with my face on the bottle. It's actually out there.
Amazing.
And to be perfectly honest, guys, the tequila is fabulous. Awesome. It's so good. It's really, really tasty. Anyway.
What is it about acting that you love and that makes you, when you get up every morning, that makes you love being an actor? What is it about the job that's enlightening and fulfilling? And what advice would you have for people who want to get into acting?
So I think one of the reasons I'm particularly fortunate is because, like you guys, I'm a product of everything I watched growing up. I love TV and I love movies. I loved coming home from lunch at school and watching the Flintstones and then coming home after school and watching the Stooges and then some Who's the Boss. And then my mom would stay up and watch Knott's Landing. I loved everything. I loved watching Errol Flynn and the Adventures of Robin Hood and Danny Kaye and the Court Jester and F. Murray Abraham in Amadeus. I remember that performance like it was yesterday. I remember my dad bringing home the beta tape from the video store, and I was probably 11 or 12, and he's saying, you have to watch this movie. And I remember being floored. I am a product of the performances of these great actors and these not so great actors that I grew up watching. And I remembered then thinking, I'm happiest when I'm watching shit. I'm happiest when I know it's terrible. It's a terrible thing to say. Yeah. You know, it's terrible. I want my kids riding horses and gardening and playing outside But the truth of the matter is, I love watching TV. I love it.
Justin may not remember this, but I think you might. The day we got cable, when we got Super Channel.
Oh, dude.
Man, movies I watched 7 or 8 times.
Of course, and that's the thing. It's like, look, I can quote all of Braveheart, all of Jerry Maguire, all of Back to the Future, all of Last Crusade. I can quote these things because I watched them thousands of times. And here's the thing. I knew as I was watching them that the reason that I love them is because they just made me feel comfortable. I loved how I felt when I was watching these things, right? Mm-hmm. And so I knew I wanted to be an actor because I wanted to be in the TV. If it felt that good to watch it, how good would it feel to do it? Now, I know there are a lot of actors that gripe about how, you know, it's not fun to make movies and it's boring. And, you know, you hear Cary Grant say, I don't get paid to act. I get paid to wait, you know, whatever it is. Right. But the truth of the matter is, guys, it's more fun making them than it is watching them. It really is. It is. It's horrible sometimes. And it's, to quote Jerry Maguire, an up at dawn pride swallowing siege sometimes. OK, but the times that it works. You're floating and it's ephemeral, you know, because it goes away as soon as it's worked. As soon as you did it, it's done. And there are a lot of stage actors that will say, no, a real actor belongs on stage with the communion of the audience. And yes, that's fun. Mm-hmm. But when it works and it's on film and you get it and it stays, it's just marvelous. So why did I want to become an actor? Because I wanted to get in the TV and feel the thing that I was feeling sitting on the couch, and then also maybe make some kids, you know, enthused by what I was doing. I experienced often in school and at home how much fun it was to entertain my family and my friends. And if I did an impression or did something that got a laugh or a rise, it was like, oh, I want to do that more. Let's do that more. So that's to answer the first part of your question. I did it because it filled me with joy, and it still does. Anytime I drive by the Paramount lot, or anytime I go to work at you know, one of the big lots, when I'm going to the Fox lot, I remember when Stooges came out, there was a massive 40-foot picture of my head at Fox.
And how cool is that?
Oh my God. Now, a lot of people are like, oh, you know, so corny. Why would you be, you know, who cares about that? And it's like, who cares? I care. I grew up loving this shit. Yeah. So yeah. I fucking love it. And that's it. So now, advice to someone getting into the business. Well, you know, I mentioned Nick Wyman, who is this very, very dear friend of mine and a tremendous character actor, Broadway actor. And he's done a ton of films and TV as well. He's just terrific. When I did Les Miserables, I was 21 years old when I started in Les Mis on Broadway. And I was in the ensemble, but I understudied Marius, the young romantic lead. And when the actor was out and I got to go on, I would especially enjoy doing the matinee Q&As with the high school classes or the middle school classes that would come to see the show, because I just thought it was cool to stand on stage and answer questions for the kids. Right. And they would ask, you know, what advice would you give to one of us and I was 21 and I remember saying, like, oh gosh, you know, you just want to, you know, you want to set your dream in front of you and believe in yourself, and you want to, you know, study your lines and don't let anyone tell you no, and just keep going for your dream. And as I was saying this, Nick Wyman, who was, you know, 45 at the time, looked at me and said, shut up. And with all due respect, shut up. Don't listen to anything this man is saying. And I was like, what the heck? And he was like, don't get into this business. It is a recipe for disaster. You won't have any fun in your life. You're going to spend your time waiting for the phone to ring and it won't ring. You won't go on honeymoons and you won't get married and you won't have birthday parties and you won't have vacations because you're thinking that you're waiting for an audition and you're hoping and waiting and you won't make a lot of money and you probably won't make any money and you'll be waiting to just don't do it. If you can do anything else, do something else that's enriching. And I remember saying to him afterwards, we walked backstage, I said, why the hell did you say that to those kids? Like, those kids are looking at you as inspiration. And he said, the ones that want to do it will do it anyway. And I remember thinking, damn, that's really, really true. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I look at my kids, and if they want to be performers, it fills me with a little bit of a pit, because I know how much pain this business has brought me. It has brought me unparalleled level of pain. Now, pain is, you know, isn't all relative, right? You know, thank goodness I'm healthy and I'm alive and my loved ones aren't dying, right? There's pain and then there's pain, right? I'm talking about emotional pain and feelings of insecurity and feelings of not being enough. And I know that feeling is just, it's a terrible one. So I want them to avoid that. But by the same token, it's also brought me great moments of elation and just feelings of real joy and pride. And I don't know, man, I think the advice that I would give is this: look at yourself in the mirror and ask yourself honestly, you know, is this something that you really think that, you know, do you think you can add value? You think you really have something, you know? And for the most part, people will answer that because they're fucking deluded and they don't have it, right? But if you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, no, I really do have something, the next question to ask yourself is, can you handle not constant rejection, but mm-hmm. only rejection. I mean, rejection coffee, rejection smoothies, rejection from morning till night. Can you handle being told no over and over and over again, or worse, not even being told anything, mm-hmm. Vying for opportunities that you never, ever hear about? Can you really handle that? Can you handle needing to uproot your family when your kids have friends somewhere in a neighborhood and saying, no, now we have to move here because this is where I'm working? And can you handle your kids looking at you saying, I hate you. Why are we, you handle being away for 6 months? So that's what I would say. Ask yourself, can you handle giving it all up? It's a pact with the devil, but the devil can look real nice sometimes.
And I work in the TV industry in Canada. I work for an independent TV station in just outside of Toronto called Yes TV. Okay. I'm a media services coordinator, so I'm in charge of like ingesting all the programs for air, quality checking them for audio, video, wow. captions, and all the commercials and promos that we air on the station as well. So my goal is to become a network television executive for cool. a TV network in Canada or the US. So that's my dream job, but I went to school for television. So yeah.
Well, so here's the deal. When you're the president of Bell or Chorus, just all I have to say is you have to green light a series that I'm starring in.
Okay.
And we'll shoot it. It'll be based in Toronto, but we'll do locations in Windsor and some of the inserts in Hamilton. Okay.
Okay. Yes.
But it will have to feature musical numbers with Jerry Jones.
Jerry Jones. Yeah.
That's the stipulation. 100%.
That's it. Yes. Yeah. It'll be called Chris with a Cherry on Top. Ooh, yeah.
I love that already.
We're so grateful that you chose to spend the time with us and share some amazing stories and background and advice. As a dad, I used to do these things. My kids are grown now, but we did these things called adventures. We wouldn't tell them what it was because the adventure could change at the drop of a hat. You probably have been able to take your kids and take your family on adventures because of what you do, because of your career. Are there any that stand out that you've been, opportunities you've had to kind of bring your family along?
What a beautiful thing that you did for your family. And by the way, how the hell you have grown kids? Did you start really young? Good for you. Jeez Louise.
I'm actually going to be a papa.
A papa? What, yeah. You mean like a grandpapa?
I'm going to be a grandpa.
No.
My oldest is 24, and he's going to become a dad at the end of this month. But thank you very much.
No pun intended. 24.
Yeah, 24. 24.
Yeah, there you go. That's good.
But thank you for the compliment. When I was glitching, that's what I was saying. Great. Thank you for the compliment. I appreciate it.
Ah, there you go.
And congratulations, Ryan.
Thank you. Yeah, congrats, dude. That's wonderful, dude. That's wonderful. We've gotten to go to a fair deal of fun places by virtue of the work. You know, when I was shooting Let's Get Physical, we shot that in Halifax. I had never worked in Halifax before. And talk about charming. That is Popeye. I mean, sure, I think they shot Popeye they shot it in Malta. They shot it in Malta. But it looks, I mean, Halifax reminded me of Popeye.
Right,
it actually did. I actually remembered thinking, wow, this reminds me of Popeye. It's just so quaint. And the people were so lovely. And so we were living in New York at the time. And I don't often, bring family with me when I'm working. I try to fly home.
Right.
But I said, you guys got to come out. And they came out, they loved it so much, they came out twice. Hmm. And it was a fabulous adventure. Kids absolutely loved it. My kids were, they were only 7 and 4. And we didn't have my littlest one at the time. But it was so much fun. We just had an absolute ball. It was East Coast Canada is a special place, man.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So that adventure really sticks out for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Adventure is the word that saved my butt so many times. Because I used to have friends that would say, and again, Mickey Mouse, they would say, kids, we're going to Disney World next month. And then something would change. And then you've got the kids all hyped up about Disney World. And I would just say adventure. And I don't know.
That's great. That's
smart. I'm sure somebody told me to do that when I was a young dad. But
that's good parenting.
It could be a Costco. It could be a water park. It could be whatever. But it could change if the plans change. So the word adventure was awesome.
That's smart.
But Yeah, just came to mind.
I was going to say, I feel like somebody asked me whether it was on the podcast or maybe you guys sent the question, but you were wondering if I was working on anything now. And I figured I might as well let you guys know there's two projects that are coming out on Netflix that I'm super excited about, actually. So, and I think they're both coming out around the same time this year. Red Notice, which is a really cool feature with Dwayne Johnson, Ryan Reynolds, and Gal Gadot.
Wow.
And and I play a real baddie in that one, which is great fun.
Nice.
And then with Kevin Hart and Wesley Snipes, I'm doing a limited series, mini series called True Story. And it's like an 8-episode mini, and it's just terrific. And I had an absolute ball working on it, and I play another nasty dude in that.
And they're both Netflix.
And then there's a few animated shows that are coming out that I'm really excited. They're both of those are on Netflix.
Okay.
I'm on Invincible right now on Amazon Prime, which is a really very, very cool animated. I play Donald, but I also play Doc Seismic in that, which is great fun. I have a show on AMC called Pantheon, which is also an adult drama animated show that's just spectacular. That's going to be coming out soon. There's an animated adult show on Netflix called Inside Job, and I play, it's one of my favorite characters. You'll have to just see the show or to see what it is. And then there's a Netflix animated children's show called Centaur World that's going to be coming out next year. That's really, really quite fun. And then finally, CBS All Access they're doing their first try at an adult animated show called Harper House. And I play some really, really awesome characters on that. But it's been great fun.
I got to say, the other CBS All Access show that you did was Twilight Zone.
That was fun.
That was the pilot.
That was really, that was
wasn't cool, the pilot. You played the pilot,
right? No, that was, I remember that episode of the original Twilight Zone used to scare the crap out of me. Uh-huh. The creature on the wing used to scare the crap out of me. I basically play the creature in this version.
Right.
Of the
Twilight. You do. Yeah.
Yeah. Effectively. But that was really a beautiful time for me for a number of reasons. One, because that job was offered to me, which was really, really nice. Two, I got to work with Adam Scott, and I'd never worked with him before. And he was just lovely to work with. And I got to shoot in Vancouver, and I always love shooting in Vancouver because I get to stay at the Sutton Place, and I get to walk around the seawall. And I love Vancouver very much.
Nice.
Yeah.
No, that was I loved the Jordan Peele series.
Yeah, that's great. They did a great job. Great
fantastic.
Job.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, honestly, I saw Twilight Zone, the movie at the theater, and I remember being equally scared by the remake they did in that.
Was that John Lithgow?
Lithgow, yes.
Yeah, man. Yeah, I mean, there's the patron saint, right? I look at, you know, Bryan Cranston, who's a friend of mine. Mm. I mean, you know, just such a spectacular actor and a wonderful person. But John Lithgow, his performance in The Crown. Can we just stop and take
Oh my goodness, yeah.
Oh my
Yeah.
And he looked nothing like Churchill. You know what I mean? Like no one's gonna say, oh, Winston Churchill, John Lithgow. You know what I mean?
Yeah, perfect.
But that is the perfect confluence of a vetted actor with a tremendously well written script with the material that just matches his quality and a budget, right? And you know, I am foolish enough to believe that if I just keep my head down and keep doing the work, that in the next 40 or 50 years, the right project that's brilliantly written, directed by exactly the right guy with a budget that's exactly what it should be, will find me and
boom,
I'll get to create truly, truly great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you're making great stuff and creating great stuff in the process. We're enjoying it.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
We found your fingerprints on the handle of the cabinet underneath the kitchen sink.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, you're free to go.
typical barrister.